This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the morning round continues. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Julian Ng and Tan Chung Han with the top business stories of the day. We start with a look at Britain, the UK's Supreme Court threw a wrench into Theresa May's Brexit plans as they ruled that the move must be formally triggered by Parliament. We have a clip here from David Davis, Secretary of State for Brexit, who told Parliament that the legislation will be debated, but he had a warning as well.
I can announce today that we will shortly introduce legislation allowing the government to move ahead with invoking Article 50, which starts the formal process of withdrawing from the European Union. Parliament will rightly scrutinise and debate this legislation, but I trust no one will seek to make it a vehicle for attempts to thwart the will of the people or frustrate or delay the process of exit from the European Union.
That was David Davis, Secretary of State for Brexit from the UK. Is this a big wrench or a small wrench, do you think, Julian?
I don't know. It feels really big because this is what the judges say, right? And they have lawmaking powers, the judges in the UK, and they ruled that the government doesn't have the prerogative powers as far as the 1972 European Communities Act is concerned. So this will, I think, have very far-reaching constitutional precedent, and it upholds parliamentary sovereignty. But you know, in a decision that was made a while back, I think one of the spokespeople from Theresa May's camp said that it's important to remember that Parliament had already backed the referendum by a margin of 6-1 and has already indicated its support for getting on with the process.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite label it as a wrench per se, but it appears to be a bump in the road. It looks like the UK's path of leaving the EU, that train is still chugging along, you know, because there appears to be enough political will on both the Conservative and Labour side to make sure Brexit happens. I mean, the people have voted, so can you imagine if they, you know, for some reason become the outcast and just really throw a spanner or wrench into the works?
Well, I think also the argument about the size of the wrench is interesting, because what the British government is saying now is that they'll be able to put this piece of legislation that's going to be fairly simple together this week, and they can get Parliament to vote on it. And the only possible big spanners or wrenches that could have come out would be if the devolved parliaments had more of a say or a veto power. They don't have. The courts have ruled that the devolved parliaments, and Scotland is the one in key focus here, does not in fact have a veto.
Yeah, in fact, I think when put it to a survey, the Scottish National Party and the Lib Dems are likely to vote against the bill if the amendments are not passed. Labour, for instance, said also that the party would not frustrate the process for invoking Article 50. And within the Conservative camp itself, you know, there are MPs who might feel that Brexit is not the right thing to do. So I think a lot of political whipping and political partisanship efforts would be made to discuss this, and I don't think it would be easy.
So, I mean, are we seeing an instance here whereby basically the electorate or the masses do not know what's in their best interest, you know, because they have voted one way? So if anyone were to throw that wrench into the works, would that imply then, you don't know what we're talking about, leave it up to Parliament and MPs to really decide, you know, for you? You know, it seems to suggest there may be some apparent limitations to democracy here.
It's called representative democracy. So, right. You don't put every decision that government makes to the vote. You do have votes. But the question was, this vote was never legally binding, right? The referendum wasn't legally binding. Parliament still had to do this. Now, the other question, I think, in terms of the Brexit vote, is that some people, remember the timeline that Theresa May gave was that they would negotiate and they would take that deal to Parliament. Now they're having to have Parliament give them the go-ahead to invoke Article 50. Does it mean that they still will go back to Parliament for the deal? And I wonder if that structure that Theresa May outlined recently still holds.
I think the market participants around the world would also be looking very closely into this. I think this is a new kind of black swan, or even a grey swan, as Nomura would like to put it. But when we spoke to Dodge this morning, he is of the view that it simplifies, actually a parliamentary vote simplifies the whole negotiation process. For example, with Scotland, the process can now be made in Parliament But then he didn't really answer the question of what if Parliament rejects the process for Article 50. I think this will actually roil the global markets.
And that's a good segue to this next point as well, because one of the key takeaways from this parliamentary ruling is the fact that, the court's ruling is that Theresa May no longer has to consult with the regional governments. So I'm wondering what is going through the minds of these Scottish voters, you know, especially given that they have voted overwhelmingly against the Brexit to begin with. The Remain camp, when the referendum was held, was at 62% versus 38% for Leave. So, you know, now you've got calls from Scottish leaders who are now saying, look, you got to show Scotland respect here. You know what I mean? So there are even calls of, I went a bit ghetto like with that whole Scotland thing. That was terrible. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying, fool? You've got now calls of Scotland perhaps making that concerted push for an independence away from the UK so that they can, you know, do their own thing and maybe join the EU.
Yeah, the big questions there, and we'll see this unfold. I think it's a story that has legs. Moving down south, Australia reaffirms its commitment to working on its trade relationships, even as President of the United States of America, Donald Trump, dealt a blow to Australia's TPP trade ambitions this week.
Yeah, so you've got those comments from the Treasury Secretary of Australia, essentially coming off the back of our discussion on this similar topic just yesterday morning. And it's interesting because I recall yesterday we asked the question, who would lead the TPP in the absence of the US, and looks like Australia wants to really step up. But then the question is, why even bother, though? Because you've got the US, or Trump, who is saying, we're going to withdraw. Japan, who have previously said that this is meaningless without the US. So you're down to about 10 countries, which probably make up only about a quarter to a third of the remaining total GDP size if all 12 original signatories were a part of it. So it's like, why even bother? Is it even big enough? Or is it just kind of, let's just do this for the sake of doing it?
I think we saw a note yesterday from Professor Jomo Kwame Sundaram, who said that to that effect that the TPP was very much moot anyway because the TPP had very little to do with trade, and the US has already free trade agreements of the bilateral and regional variety with 6 of the 11 countries off the TPP, original TPP pact, and all the 12 members belong to the World Trade Organization, the WTO. In fact, he thinks that the TPP would reinforce things like patents and copyrights and would make pharmaceutical products more expensive. And he also thinks that the ISDS, which is that International Settlement Dispute Court, will remove the sovereignty of the governments and allow companies to sue governments for ostensible losses. So is there a lot lost from this loss of TPP? I don't know.
Well, okay, so I think what you've done is to give much of the anti-TPP positions, right? This is going into the conversations that we had prior to the Malaysian government's firm decision to go ahead with TPP. These were the arguments that were made. But Julian, there's another side to that discussion, which was that that the Malaysian economy is moribund, that it's stuck, and there are lots of barriers to us, putting the fire and igniting the economy again. And what the TPP was going to do was to provide that with its new rules, whether it's on labor, whether it's on procurement, whether it's about the state versus private sector. All those things was what the free trade advocates and the pro-TPP side put out there as the reasons for us going into
it.
I
don't know about that, though, because the government had an opt-out as far as procurement was concerned.
No, there were some carve-outs, but the carve-outs had limitations too, right?
So I don't know about the resolve to make Malaysia a more efficient economy. Maybe right now this will push the countries involved to pursue other bilateral trade talks or multilateral trade talks, which would not be disadvantageous to us. For example, a deal with China may be quite advantageous as well, with the RCEP on the cards. I think that might not be a bad thing.
Maybe we'll just end this discussion with some comments from Tokpa here. That's our Trade Minister, Mustapha Mohamed. He's saying that the focus will be to enhance the economic integration of the AEC EEC, that's the ASEAN Economic Community. But then again, you know, it kind of begs the question, so won't it just be business as usual? Anyways, ASEAN is already the largest trading bloc for Malaysia, you know, so the TPP being that catalyst for global growth, you know, looks like, you know, its future is very much uncertain.
Okay, we'll be back with more business news after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.